Okay, folks. Couple of reminders in case you still need them. The first is for those of you who haven't turned in your DCFs. It's Friday at 5. But I'm going to undercut myself. If you don't get done by 5 on Friday, if it's 7 on Friday, 8 a.m. on Saturday, 3 p.m. on Sunday, sometime over the weekend you get done, send it in anyway. So, you know, I'll try to get it back to you. Two things on the DCFs. As I look at the DCFs, there are two ends of the distribution that I want to kind of talk to. One is a few of you, very few of you. Most of you are doing a good job getting the numbers in, and a few tweaks is all I've suggested. A few of you are using the spreadsheet almost as random input generators where you enter a growth rate, you enter a margin, you send it in, say, what do you think about this? And I look at your numbers and say, what universe are you on? So think about the story. This is not a number crunching exercise. It's not a modeling game. This is a real company in a real market with real competitors. You need to think through a story. I'm not going to say in fact, you can come up with a story no matter how much you stretch the story. I'm okay with it. It's your story. But I want you to think about the story first before you enter the number. So that's one side of the distribution. Don't just input numbers and let the spreadsheet kind of take care of it. At the other end of the distribution, and this is natural when you do valuation, some of you get stuck in a detail that probably doesn't matter that much. I'll give you an example. You have a young growth company that's losing money. There's lease commitments. What do you have to do to lease commitments? You've got to take the present value, right? To get the present value, what do you need? You need a pre-tax cost of debt. What are the two ways you get a pre-tax cost of debt? One is you can look up an actual rating, which you're not going to find for a young company with no debt. Or you can do a synthetic rating, right? And what's the problem you're going to face when you try to do a synthetic rating for a young growth company that's losing money? Your EBIT is going to be negative, your interest coverage ratio is going to be minus, and you're going to give them a D rating. Basically, you're going to say the default. So you can get stuck in this. What the heck do I do now? And what I want you to do is step back and gain some perspective. This is probably a company where the lease commitments are $10 million a year for the next 10 years. It's a $10 billion market cap company. You could ask yourself, what effect is it going to have on my debt ratio if I use a 5% cost? I make up a cost of debt. I'm not suggesting that this is something you do on a systematic basis. But on cases like this where it's not a big issue, pick a double B. Cost of debt and keep moving. Why double B? Because a DCF is a going concern valuation. You want to pick a single C or a double C. So pick a cost of debt and move on. So sometimes when you get stuck on a detail, stop and ask yourself, does it really matter that much? Right? And if it doesn't matter that much, move on. There are bigger issues in your valuation. The other reminder, and I'm sure some of you are going to be surprised, or you shouldn't be because it's on the calendar, it's been on the calendar since the start of class, is a week from today, what do you have? Second quiz. Okay. So your second quiz is a week from today. All the usual rules apply. So you need to let me know before the quiz if you're going to miss it. If you did badly on the first quiz, try not to miss this quiz because then your first quiz stands. So essentially, this... You need to take all three quizzes to get that option of the worst quiz being pushed up to the average. So it's the first 30 minutes of class, and I'll send out the seating arrangements soon, and I'll also put up the review online by tomorrow. Any questions? Okay. So let's start with today's... Today we're going to continue with our discounted cash flow valuations of full companies. Let's look at a few preview test questions. Sometime today, maybe not today, maybe even Monday, we will talk about valuing commodity companies, oil companies, iron ore companies, mining companies. And as all of you know, commodity prices have dropped fairly dramatically over the last year and a half. So this is kind of a generic question. Forget about where we are right now. Commodity companies, if you look at their earnings, and this is going to be true across the board and over history, their earnings are going to go up and down as commodity prices go up and down. So that's almost a given. So my question is about value. Let's say you're a commodity analyst and you're doing discounted cash flow valuations of a commodity company. Given that earnings go up and down, will your value also be going up and down, or what will drive how your values evolve over time? You value a commodity company, what are you required to do? Value the company for the long term, right? Across cycles. So if you're valuing across cycles, the fact that earnings are up now or down now by itself should not drive your valuation. But having said that, I'll also tell you it's almost impossible to get away from. Right? You can tell yourself you want to be long term, but if you're in a $40 oil price, you view the world very differently than if you're in a $110 oil price. So we're going to come back and talk about what to do about that discomfort you're going to feel when you value a commodity company, saying, I valued ExxonMobil today, but what if tomorrow oil prices go to 80 or 20? So we'll talk about things that can make you feel better and perhaps give you a better perspective on value. We'll also talk about financial service companies. We're going to be valuing banks, insurance companies, investment banks. Okay? And one of the things we're going to kind of emphasize with those companies is the importance of regulatory capital. It's going to take on the role of land and equipment and building for a manufacturing company. And if you look across banks, even though there's a minimum regulatory capital requirement, not all banks stay at the minimum. Some are more conservative than others. Conservative in the sense they build in a big buffer. So let's say you're valuing a bank that is very conservatively run. Its regulatory capital is way above. So the minimum is 6%, they're at 10%. So you sit down to value the bank, you use free cash flow, equity, dividends, whatever you decide to use. My question is about numbers you're going to observe about this bank. Given that it has all this regulatory capital over and above requirements, which of the following four combinations are you going to see in this bank? A high return equity, low risk, low return equity, low risk, a high return equity, high risk, and a low return equity, high risk. Let's take each half. What's the return equity? It's net income divided by book equity, right? So if you're overcapitalized, what's going to happen to book equity? It's going to get pushed up. Your return in equity is going to get pushed down. And because you've got more equity at play. So you're going to have low return equity, not high return equity, because a lot more of your capital is just sitting around to meeting regulatory requirements, not being, you know, not being put to full use. But it also makes you a less risky bank, right? And the reason I bring that up is this is something we're going to have to wrestle with, because how do we compute a cost of equity? We take risk-free rate plus beta times equity risk premium. And at least for banks, there's no easy way to adjust the beta for regulatory capital. So we might want to connect the two, that the betas for banks that are undercapitalized or minimally capitalized should be higher than the betas for banks that are well capitalized. I'm not sure how to do it, so I'll kind of suggest a couple of ways. But that's something to think about as you look across banks. At the end of all of this, by Monday, we're going to come up with a value. And by Friday evening, hopefully each of you will have a value for your company. And it's going to be different from the price. Some of you might be close, but I don't think it's going to be ever exactly equal. But let's say that you found a company where the price is way lower than the value that you've estimated. So let's say your value is 50, the price is 35. You feel really sure about yourself. You feel that you have a good story. You've made a really good job estimating the cash flows. You feel good about your valuation. Would you be willing to put all your money in that stock? What are you uncertain about? What are the two things you're uncertain about? One is that even if your value is perfect, that the price has to adjust to the value, right? So it's not just being certain about your valuation, it's about getting the price to adjust. The second is, even certainty about valuation is relative. Nobody's 100% certain. So the two things you're uncertain about is my value right, and will the price converge on the value? The reason I bring this up is in old-time value investing. You know what I mean by old-time value investing. These are the people who go to Omaha and preach to you about how to invest. You're told that diversification is a bad thing. You shouldn't buy too many stocks. You should keep your investments focused. Five or six companies. This diversification thing is an academic thing. And they almost go, diversification, they don't stop. They go to index funds. It's index funds or six stocks. There's nothing in between. And I've never understood why it's an all or nothing. Can't you be a value investor who invests in 20 stocks rather than in five? And when you invest in five stocks, the hubris you're bringing to the game. almost asks for you to be taken down, right? Because what are you saying? I feel so sure about my valuations, the market correcting, that I can put my money in 5 stocks. And the more uncertain you start to get about your valuations and the market adjusting, the more stocks you need in your portfolio. Do you see that? So if you're investing in sectors which are shifting, transitioning, then your portfolios almost by definition have to be 20 or 25 stocks rather than 5. And that's, I think, one of the lessons that comes out of 2008 is don't mess with this 5-stock portfolio. I don't care how good you are at valuation. You're asking for too much trouble along the way. The final two slides are not on yours, but you're going to wonder why I'm even talking about the slides, but I'll connect it as we start talking about the stuff for today. So let's say you decide sometime today that you made a bad mistake coming to business school, that you should have gone to weather forecasting school. I don't even know whether there's a school for weather forecasting, but you go to that school, they teach you how to have nice hair, point to blank walls, and you get the right state. That's a big skill set in weather forecasting. If you've ever been in a studio, there's nothing on the wall, actually, when they point to the wall. The map is all on the TV, so you got to be pointing to Nevada when you mean Nevada, not when you mean New York. So you're really good. You point at exactly the right point in the blank wall, and you pass with flying colors, the top of your class, and you're now looking for a job. And you have two offers. And I'll tell you, before you look at these two offers, you want to be a star weather forecaster. You say, what does that mean? Remember the 30-minute local news that comes on? You want to be on for 27 of those 30 minutes. And here are your two jobs. The first is Honolulu, Hawaii. So don't jump. You're already saying it's cold outside. I've made my decision already. Hang in there, you know. Honolulu, Hawaii. The second is Epping, North Dakota. I've never been to Epping. I don't want to be in Epping. I don't want to be near Epping. Yeah? But it's out there in North Dakota. You know why I picked these two places? Honolulu, Hawaii has the most predictable weather in the United States. Predictable in what sense? The variation in temperatures is the least across the year, and the change from dry to wet to dry is the lowest. So basically, if yesterday was 83 and sunny, guess what tomorrow is going to be? Okay. 83 and sunny. Epping, North Dakota has the most unpredictable weather in the country. Biggest swings in temperature. You can go from sunny to snowy the next day. So let me ask you the first question. In which of these two cities is the weather going to be easier to forecast? Honolulu, right? I can forecast the weather for Honolulu tomorrow. It's going to be 82 and sunny. And odds are, I haven't even looked at the paper, that I'm going to be pretty close to the truth. So if you go to Honolulu, Hawaii as the weather forecaster, how much time are you going to spend in front of the camera? They're probably going to skip your segment, right? You'll be delivering coffee to the other guys. We'll be talking about the surfing news for tomorrow. You're not going to be the star. Whereas in Epping, North Dakota, the news is all about you. A blizzard comes, you're dancing in your room saying, it's me, it's me, it's me. I mean, if you were in New York last winter, December, notice what happens to local weather, especially when a snowstorm is coming. 27 minutes, a weather forecaster is on. The last 3 minutes, the guy said, oh, there's a lot of other stuff that happened in the world today. Russia invaded Ukraine, but we'll come back to that tomorrow after the weather forecaster updates the blizzard. You want to be a star, you want to be in Epping, North Dakota. That's where the payoff, even though it's not because you're going to be more right in Epping, North Dakota, it's the payoff to forecasting the weather in Epping, North Dakota is much greater than the payoff to forecasting the weather in Honolulu. You say, that's a valuation class. Why the heck is he talking about weather forecasting? You're going to see in a minute, because I'm going to finish that section on young companies. And I'm going to talk about how uncertain I felt about valuing Amazon in 2000, and how uncertain I felt in 2001, how uncertain I feel today about Twitter, and why that's where I gravitate when I do valuation. Not to the Procter and Gambles and the Coca-Colas of the world. And some of you might start to make the connection already, but that's going to be the next phase. So I'm going to go back to the notes and complete the last few pieces. So remember last session, I valued Amazon. And I started listing out things. Don't trust the beta. Work backwards to get your revenues. Now the lesson to remember, just because you're valuing a young growth company doesn't mean you can forget all about reinvestment. But in this case, I'm going to connect reinvestment to your revenues, not your operating income, because that's where the action is. And the metric I use to come up with reinvestment is you tell me how much your revenues change. In this case, those are my estimated revenue changes by year. I'm going to use the sales to cap ratio to estimate how much I reinvest. So in year one, for instance, my revenues increased by $1.676 billion. It goes from what it is today, $1.1 billion all the way to $2.7 billion. So my revenues increased by 1.676. My sales to capital ratio is 3 to 1. So for every $3 in revenues, I need a dollar in capital. I divide the 1676 by 3. I've got my reinvestment. You know what's in reinvestment? It's CapEx minus depreciation plus change in working capital, all consolidated into one number. You're saying, why are you consolidating into one number? Why not break it down? Because I have no idea where Amazon is going to reinvest. Amazon has no idea where it's going to reinvest. It could be acquisitions, it could be R&D. Why should you try to break things down when you really don't have the information? So that's my reinvestment. And that reinvestment actually plays a very interesting role. We don't think of it in this way when we do cash flows, but when we have a reinvestment to get to a free cash flow to the firm, that reinvestment is the change in your invested capital. When we talked about invested capital to get to return on invested capital, book debt plus book equity minus cash. So that's your starting number. And each year when you reinvest, your invested capital increases by your reinvestment. So your reinvestment is positive, your invested capital is rising. If your reinvestment is zero, your invested capital stays constant. If your reinvestment is negative, you're actually running through your invested capital. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that reinvestment, add it on to my starting invested capital, which I know, and then I'm going to divide my estimate of the after-tax operating income that I got 2 pages ago. Remember that after-tax operating income I had? I'm going to divide that after-tax operating income by my estimate of invested capital to get what I call an imputed return on capital. You say, why are you going through this contortion? Sometimes on spreadsheets, you can create companies that are magical companies. Dreamscape companies is what I call them. Companies that exist only in your dreams. What I'm trying to figure out is that company that I've created in year 10, is that a company I'm comfortable with? And one of the numbers I want to check is what kind of return on capital have I given this company in year 10? Remember, I didn't estimate return capital directly. It comes out of my numbers. What kind of return on capital have I given this company? And am I okay with it? In the case of Amazon, when I get to year 10, based on my after-tax operating income that came from the margins and my invested capital that came from the sales to cap ratio, the return on capital I got was 20.39%. In 2000, I was okay with that number. Why was I okay with the number? Interest rates were much higher. The average return on capital for retail firms was 15 to 16%. I said, you know what? I think Amazon can earn a 20% return on capital. You know what I would not have been okay with? If that had been a 200.39% return on capital in year 10, what's my spreadsheet telling me? I'm not reinvesting enough, right? Can I fix it? What's the number that I can use to fix it? I go back and I lower my sales to capital or raise my sales to capital ratio. You got a 50-50 shot. I lower my sales to capital ratio. I'll reinvest more. My return on... There's feedback in your own spreadsheet. And that's why if you look at my FCFF Simple Ginzo at the bottom, I actually compute your imputed return on capital. Most of you didn't even get down to that last row. But take a look at it because I'm saying given what you're telling me about your sales to capital and your growth rate, this is what your return on capital will look like in year 10. So use that feedback to figure out whether you're reinvesting enough in this company. And along the way, it is true, and this is going to be true for most young growth companies, you're going to be raising new equity, you're going to be issuing options to employees, because that's what young growth companies do. Don't worry about it. You say, but that will change the number of shares. It doesn't matter. Here's why. Why do you have to issue new equity? It's because your free cash flow of the firm are negative, right? And if your free cash flow of the firm is negative, and we did this at the start of the class test a couple of sessions ago, your present value is going to be lower. You've already factored in the dilution. You can just let it go. So if anybody asks you, how come you're not counting the number of shares that the company has to issue in year one, year two, tell them it's already counted in when you do the present value. And the equity options we've already talked about. If you think your company will keep granting equity options to its employees because it doesn't have the cash, build it in as a cost item. It reduces your operating income and your cash flows. So your discounted cash flow valuation has already factored both those issues in. So I finish this Amazon valuation. I get, you know, $34. Stock's at 80-something. And the very last question I was asked on that webcast, it must have been from somebody who actually owned Amazon, was, is it possible that Amazon's worth $84? What's the answer to that question? Possible is the weakest word in the English language. Probably there are weaker words, but it's pretty close to the weakest word. It's one reason I don't like our school. Everything in the school is possible this, possible that. Let's talk plausible, probable, right? This is exactly the problem with possible. Okay. Of course it's possible. In fact, for Amazon to be worth $84, what has to happen? The revenue growth has to be higher than expected, and or the margins have to be higher than expected, right? It's simple mathematics. So here's what I did. I used a 42% compounded revenue growth. I changed that revenue growth from 42 to 30, 35, 40, 45, 50, 55, kept going. And remember that exercise we tried? Going from 42 to 60 is a huge increase in terms of your end revenues. Your end revenues will end up becoming 120 billion rather than 40 billion. So I increased my compounded revenue growth. I used a 10% margin. I said, what if the margin were 12, 14? See these shaded areas? Those are the values that exceed $84. Think of this as break-even points. For Amazon to be worth more than $84 per share, here's what it has to do. It has to grow like Walmart and have margins like Ann Taylor. And if you think that is a good story to tell, invest in Amazon. And that's one way in which you can ask questions about your own valuation, is ask those what if questions to get to the market price and say, what does the story have to be for me to justify the price that I see out there? So if you take a LinkedIn, work it out and say, is that a story I'm comfortable with? If you're comfortable with it, then the possible just became plausible, and the plausible might even have become probable. Go out and invest in the stock. And final reminder, as you finish this valuation and you look at that value, you should be uncomfortable. Why? Because you're going to be wrong 100% of the time. And let me explain what I mean by 100% of the time. I have never ever done a valuation of a company where my revenues and operating income have come in exactly as I expected over the next 10 years, ever. And with companies like this, you're going to get huge differences, and you have to be okay with it. And I've used this line before, but I'll use it again, because you don't have to be right, you just have to be less wrong than everybody else. And that's a way to think about Honolulu and Epping, North Dakota. You are going to be more wrong in Epping, North Dakota than in Honolulu, but as the weather forecast in Epping, you just have to be a little better than everybody else on the street, and maybe all the tools you learned in weather forecasting school will allow you to be a little better. Your payoff to doing valuation is greatest where the noise is greatest, where the uncertainty is greatest, because that's where the pricing mistakes are also going to be greatest. Yes? You want to answer that? What are you dividing by the number of shares? The value that you got for the equity, right? How do you get that value? You took cash flows and you discounted them back. Why are you issuing shares in years 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5? Because your cash flows were negative. The only reason to issue shares is because your cash flows are negative, right? So when you did the present value of your cash flows, if you had negative cash flows of $1 billion every year for the first 6 years, your present value today, for Amazon, for instance, the present value that I got of $14 billion, because they had negative cash flows in the first 7 years, that present value was about $6 billion lower than would have been if they didn't have those negative cash flows. So my value has been knocked down by 30%. Why? Because I expect negative cash flows. Now, I'm going to issue shares to cover those negative cash flows, and if I count those shares as well in my denominator, I've ended up double counting. So once I get the 14 billion, I can forget about all future share issues and say, look, I've got the value with the dilution built into the cash flows. And the nice thing is, it saves you that circular logic. Do you see why there's going to be circular logic otherwise? Because to figure out how many shares you have to issue in year 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, you need a price. And that's what you're trying to estimate. This way you avoid that entire problem and just focus in on the present value and say it's already factored in. But be ready to make that pitch. It's amazing how many people doing valuation don't quite get that. You will have seasoned equity research analysts, and I use the word seasoned in as nice a way as I can. Very seasoned. Over-seasoned. Who will insist that you should divide by the fully diluted, counting shares that are going to be issued in the future. Don't fall for it, because if you do that, you're essentially going to double count the same dilution. So you saw the valuation in 2000, right? Start of 2000, peak of the dot-com boom. Everybody's incredibly optimistic about dot-com stocks. I valued Amazon at the peak. And I would love to tell you that I was unaffected by what was happening around me, but you can't help it. If everybody's incredibly optimistic, it percolates into your valuation and the assumptions you make. 1 year later, just 12 months. But what a difference 12 months can make. During these 12 months, here's what happened. The dot-com boom bust. The economy, which we'd been told would never go into recession again, because this was the new economy, went into a recession. Dot-com retailing as a business started imploding. Because all these companies that had been telling people, look, we have website visitors, were suddenly facing their bar mitzvah moments and failing the test. So 12 months later, I revalued Amazon. And I revalued it again for AMR, for the CFA webcast series. And this time the question was, will anybody ever want to buy a dot-com stock again? Very different question than the previous year. So I revisited the valuation. And because the outside world has to be reckoned with, I used a lower compounded revenue growth rate. And the best way to think about this is in 2000 when I valued Amazon. You remember? Does anybody remember what my ending revenues were? I think about it ended up with about 40. Notice how I've scaled down my expectations because of what's going on around. I said, maybe this business is a lot more difficult than I thought it was. My end margin, instead of being 10%, had dropped to the industry average, which itself had been pushed down to 9.32%. During the year, Amazon did borrow about $1.7 billion. In my view, that's what saved Amazon as a company, is they borrowed the money and they held it as a cash balance. And you're going to see in a minute why it saved the company. And what that did was it increased their debt ratio, made them a riskier company in terms of cost of debt, but the cost of equity actually did not increase that much because the risk-free rate went from 6% down to 5.1%. So cash flows are now a little lower, growth is lower, cost of care. The interesting thing is, as I get more pessimistic about the company, remember I had 6 years of negative cash flows before? I now have only 4 years of negative cash flows. You see, how can you be more pessimistic? What's happening? Why is becoming more pessimistic actually helping me on the cash flows? When I'm pessimistic, I'm lowering growth, right? When I lower growth, what else is changing? My reinvestment is changing. And that's why when you see the valuation of a young growth company and you see positive cash flows, it's not a good sign. It basically means that the company is scaling back its growth investments. And that's not a good sign for you as an investor, because it effectively might give you positive cash flows now, but lower growth in the future. Discount the cash flows, the value that I got was $8.8 billion. In fact, why don't you guys go back 5 pages and stay on the 2000 valuation so we can compare the numbers? So the value that I think I got in 2000 was $14.6 billion for the operating assets. So I've knocked off about $5.6 billion. Pretty large knockoff. The cash balance was $26 million, almost zero in 2000. It shows you how confident they felt about being able to, is now $1.26 billion. Their debt, which used to be almost nothing, 300 and something million, is now $1.9 billion. I get a value for the equity of $8.1 billion, which is about $6 billion lower than it was a year ago. If you're an Amazon investor in 2000, it's been a really, really, really bad year, right? You know the only silver lining in this dark cloud? The only thing that's moved in your favor is what? What were the equity options worth in early 2000? 2.9 billion. What are they worth now? 845 million. Unless the company feels you haven't suffered enough and decides to take you to the cleaners one last time. You know what tech companies did in when the dot-com boom bust? What did many of them do to options? Because many of these options were issued when the stock price was 45. The stock had dropped to 15. So what did many of them do to kind of keep those options afloat? They repriced the options. You're saying, what does that mean? They changed the strike price on the options from 45 down to 15. An absolutely unconscionable exercise, if you ask me. But what is the excuse they gave? If we don't do this, what will happen? They will leave. Who's they? The employees. And let's face it, it's the top three guys who have all the options. It's not all the other employees. They will leave. To which my response is, my stock is down 80%. Why are you stopping them? Push them out of the door. Lock the door. Don't let them back in. Don't give me this nonsense about if we don't do it, they will leave. In fact, it took about 9 months for institutional investors to even realize this was happening to them. They had no idea what this repricing even meant. The board of directors just slipped it through. But by the time you got to January 2000, they had finally woken up. So I'm assuming that Amazon doesn't reprice the options. So I subtract out the options. The value per share that I got was 21, as opposed to the 34 that I got a year ago. So I finished the valuation. Last question I get asked is, aren't you uncomfortable that your value changed so much in 1 year? To which my response was, after a year like last year, I'd be uncomfortable if my value did not change at least this much. But it cuts to the core. People say, it's intrinsic value, it shouldn't change. It will change. It has to change. The value that you have for your company today might change dramatically after one earnings report. So somebody sent me a Twitter valuation this morning. Twitter's earnings report is coming out, I think, this evening. It's out already? Okay. Okay, so there's your values. So you have to revisit your numbers and say, oh my God, everything's changed. That's the nature of young growth companies. Okay. Final point. One more thing. If you think I've changed my mind going from 34 to 21, what was the market at a year ago? 84. In fact, by the time I did this particular webcast, it was down to $11 and dropping. Pricing mistakes, value mistakes. Okay, so I made a value mistake, $13 mistake, 34 to 21. Look at the pricing mistake. And this time I was trapped. Remember a year ago when I did the valuation and I came up with this value that was way lower than the price? And I set up this question, would you short sell? And what was my response on whether I would sell short on Amazon in early 2000? I gave you the song and dance about it's too tough to do long term, so I can't do it. So I was able to walk away from that valuation without any damage to my portfolio. So I wish in hindsight I'd sold short. Now do you see what the question's going to be? So are you buying? Half my portfolio, I've been trapped into buying. Because you ask this question, there are three possible answers you can give. No, in which case, what have you told people, the rest of the world, about your own valuations? Nice number crunching exercise, but I can't act on that. I can say yes and lie, but no way of knowing. How can you get into my portfolio? Let me not set up that as a challenge. You get a Russian hacker, next thing I know, my portfolio is out there for the whole world to know. Or yes and buy. In this case, I did the yes and buy. I bought at 11. Stock went to 6. Wrong direction, in case you're wondering. Because it was touch and go for a while. If you remember, in 2000, that was the year that Amazon had to survive. Because what happened to the rest of the dot-com sector? Basically disappeared. Remember what I said about Amazon raising debt, saving it? You know how they survived that year? They used the cash balance. They cut back on all growth. And in fact, this is, if you look at Jeff Bezos' life at Amazon, this was his defining moment. Because what he did was, we have to survive. He said, he cut back on reinvestment, he used the cash to survive. And when he came out, he actually was in a stronger position than when he went in, because his competition had essentially disappeared. And everybody wanted to use the Amazon retail site to sell their stuff. So I bought Amazon in 2001. And I kept revaluing Amazon. Why let go? You valued a company. You've done the dirty work. Might as well revisit it. So every 6 months, every year, I'd revalue Amazon. In 2002, it stayed undervalued. 2003 summer, it shot up. Don't ask me what caused it shot up. But I sold. I bought Amazon four times in the last 15 years. I've sold Amazon four times in the last 15 years, which tells you a little bit about where I am with Amazon right now. You can work out the math. But what I'm also trying to say is, you often hear people say, never ever will I invest in that stock. Why do people say, oh, I will never invest in a young tech company. I will never invest in a Facebook. Never say never. Is that a Justin Bieber song? No, never mind. Never say never on an investing, because at today's price, you can say, I want to invest in the stock. But who knows? 6 months from now, this might be exactly the stock you want to invest in. So don't throw away valuations you've done. Kind of revisit them, update them, because stocks can go from being undervalued to overvalued to undervalued again. So it's not like buy and forget. Don't do that with these companies. That's not the type of investing it is. You buy and track. So I bought Twitter at 27. I don't even know what it's going to open at today. Okay, I'm still in the positive territory, but if it went to 18, am I going to panic? Not quite yet. But the urge will pop up, right? Maybe I should revisit my valuation. But I'll keep revisiting it, and if it goes to 45 in 10 days, it'll be tough to pull the trigger. Even though I want to, because the tax issue is kind of hanging over. You see what the tax issue is going to do to you? It'll be a 4-week holding period, which effectively means I've got to pay ordinary taxes. Taxes are, to me, the biggest irritant when it comes to investing, because it kind of cuts into what you want to do, makes you delay things. But there are ways of getting around that. But that's something to remember with these young companies, is essentially revisit those valuations. Any questions on valuing young companies? I know many of you are valuing young companies, LinkedIn, and you know. So essentially, go through that process, do the best you can, because that's all you can do. Then do the karmic thing. Let it go. You've done all you can. You got a value. There's a price. Keep coming back to it. You know, someday it might end up being in your portfolio. Yes?
Isn't this more about predicting where the market is going, predicting what's going to happen for the company, as opposed to, you know, using the art of valuation?
Predicting. Isn't valuation always about... Can you name me a company where you're not predicting? It's always predicting, right? The only difference is predicting with Coca-Cola, we have a crutch. What's a crutch you use? You use history. That's all it is. It's prediction without a crutch, as opposed to prediction with a crutch. It's always about the future. The only thing is, if you have an established company with an established business model, the predictions get a little easier because there's a little bit more to go on. But it's always about the future. So if tomorrow you had a narrative break with Coca-Cola, say you find out that colas cause cancer, all cola sales across the world stop. Doesn't matter how much of a history you have, how much money you've made, how much advertising you've spent on, your company basically disappears. It's always about the future. The question is, how much estimation error is there going to be in the future, right? And that's what's different about young companies as opposed to more mature companies, which actually is a great launching pad. Any other questions on young companies? For the next phase of valuations, let's talk about valuing those easy-to-value companies. The nice thing about mature companies is they have established business models, they have lots of history, and they're set in their ways. You see what I mean by set in their ways? You can see what they borrow, you can see how much they reinvest. The managers have been running this company for 35 years. It runs on autopilot, to be quite honest. See, this should be easy. And you're right, it is easy to value the company in its existing ways. But can you get set in bad ways? Yeah, sure, you can pick up some bad habits, right? So if you have a company that's never borrowed money and continues not to borrow money, you can value the company on the assumption it'll never borrow money. But you can stop and ask the question, why do you guys not borrow money? Or why do you keep reinvesting in these projects that make terrible returns? So with mature companies, valuation gets difficult when that question rises to the surface. That's why I use the example of Mondelez being targeted by Nelson Peltz, or Procter & Gamble with Bill Ackman. These are companies, we have mature companies set in their ways, with somebody saying, hey, you guys have been doing this for a long time, but it doesn't seem to be working. So if you think about the questions to which I need the answers to, What are the casualties? Think about how those questions will look if you're asking them of a Montclair or Procter & Gamble. So when I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets, you pull out your financial statements. Look, those are my cash flows. And then I ask you, are you running these assets efficiently? Maybe you're not. Maybe your factory's open you shouldn't have open. Maybe there are cheaper ways of doing things. Then I ask you, how much value do you create from growth? You show me what you do. You don't reinvest very much. You don't reinvest very well. And I say, maybe you can do that differently. With each question, there is an answer I get from what you do and an answer I can give you on what you should be doing. Which means you're almost two parallel paths you go through, right? You have one path where you have the status quo. And you come up with the value based on the status quo. On the other path, you have, what if I ran this company differently? And you come up with a different value, presumably a higher value with you running the company. So let's try this. You've heard of Hormel Foods? You know what the most famous product is? The most disgusting concoction ever known to man? You've never seen it? It's meat in a can with a life of 200 years. Think about that. Okay. It's Spam. Have you ever seen it? It's slimy stuff, but okay. It was, of course, concocted by the U.S. Army during the Second World War when soldiers were coming back from Asia. They had to stop in Hawaii because not because they wanted the sunshine, but because you couldn't make it all the way back to the mainland. And if you've been in Hawaii, it's not exactly got enough food to feed, so they created Spam. And if you go to Hawaii, you can actually get cookbooks. Spam. Just on Spam. Just buy one. Don't ever cook with Spam. Just buy one. It's like watching an alien tribe eat. So Hormel Foods is an old-time company that produces these goods. It's somewhere in Pennsylvania. It used to be a family-owned company, then became a family-run company. Now it's a family foundation company. But it's a company that's actually very set on its ways. It's a very conservative company. It's a very conservative company in what sense? It doesn't use much debt. It's never used much debt. Why? Because the managers don't like debt. The family doesn't like debt. It doesn't reinvest very much. It reinvests about 19% of its income, and it reinvests primarily in the U.S. It doesn't like to go outside the U.S., and its return on capital is not bad, 14.34%. So I valued it as this, with a low debt ratio, and a low reinvestment rate and a low growth rate. Nothing wrong with it. It's a conservative company. The value that I got per share was $31.91. That's if the existing management ran the company. Then I revalued the company. This is where corporate finance meets valuation, right? Because in corporate finance, wasn't this a question we were asking? Can we run this company differently? So I changed the debt ratio from 10.4% to 40%. You're saying, why 40%? In a minute, I'll back that up as to why 40, why not 30, why not 70. That lowers my cost of capital from 6.79% to 6.63%. Not a huge change, but a slight drop in the cost of capital. I did assume that they could go out and be a little more aggressive in their reinvestment, especially if they looked outside the U.S. I pushed the reinvestment rate to 40%, but I conceded that that'll probably mean taking projects that earn a lower return. So I used a lower return on capital and a higher reinvestment rate, giving them a higher growth rate. So with a higher growth rate and a slightly lower cost of capital, the value that I get per share is $37.80. So I have two values for the company. So what the heck do I do with two numbers? My expected value for the company then is a weighted average of those two numbers. Weighted by what? Weighted by the likelihood that I can actually change the status quo. This is where corporate governance comes in, right? So what do I check? I check to see who owns shares in the company, who controls the company. And in particular, I looked at the largest stockholder in Hormel Foods, and it was the Hormel Family Foundation, the old family holdings. Then I was able to get my hands on who ran the Hormel Family Foundation, and I found that the Hormel CEO is also the head of the Hormel Family Foundation. What does it tell me about corporate governance? That in this company, changing the way the company is run is going to be really difficult. It's not going to be impossible because family foundations can be shifted. I gave them a 10% chance of change and a 90% chance of no change. My expected value is a weighted average of my status quo value, weighted by 90%, and my optimal value, 10%. The value per share that I got was $32.50. Let's say right after I finish this, I read a news story that Carl Icahn has taken a position in Hormel Foods. Which number is going to change? Just the probabilities. The values don't change, right? The 3191 and the... So that's the way to think about why activist investing affects prices. Is it changes the probability that you move towards your optimal value. And by doing that, it can push up your price. So when you think about mature companies, that is something to think about. Here are a couple of follow-up things. Because especially now that mature companies are being targeted by activist investors, there's a lot of talk. And often that talk is around cost cutting. That you can cut $3 billion in costs. And people throw numbers out there. Oh, you can cut $6 billion in costs, $10 billion in costs. I mean, usually these numbers are thrown around by people who've never cut a cost in their life. Cost cutting is really, really, really difficult to do. I remember in the late 1990s, J.P. Morgan announced these major cost cuts. So that's what the Wall Street Journal, they're going to cut costs $2 billion. And now, J.P. Morgan is a company I've been teaching at for 30-something years. And this, I used to teach at 37 Wall, which is this old building right next to the old J.P. Morgan corner building right across from the exchange. The building next to it used to belong to J.P. Morgan. This narrow, decrepit building. You walked in through a narrow corridor. You had to pass J.P. Morgan security. This is like, you know, passing through from, you know, across the barbed wires into Russia or something. So they ask you for your name, your last 3 years of tax records, you know, do you have a fingerprint, etc. You pass through and you come to this panel of elevators, and there used to be an old guy who sat in front of those elevators for the first 12 years that I went in. And this is what his job seemed to be. And this is just some, you'd press the button for the elevator would come down, the doors would open, and he'd point. So why? Maybe he's doing it for blind people, but blind people can't see him. Is it for deaf people, but deaf people can see? So I couldn't quite figure out. But for 12 years, he pointed and you got on. I would always wonder, what if he didn't point? Can I still get on? I never tested that proposition. And then they announced major cost cutting. A week later, I go into the building. The old guy is gone. That's a major cost cut. The poor guy got his job probably because he saved J.P. Morgan from falling down a shaft or something, and J.P. Morgan said, from this day on, you just sit in a chair and point to an elevator. You got a job for life. How much did you save? $35,000? Cost cuts get progressively less likely to happen the closer they get to the top management. As a general proposition, you can take that. Replacing business class with coach class, that's not going to happen. That's too much discomfort. So in most cases, when you see companies announce $1 billion in cost cuts, you're going to be lucky to see $400 million actually being cut. Right? So this actually is from a McKinsey study that looked at what kinds of companies actually deliver on cost cuts and what do they share in common. And it turned out that what you need, and this is no surprise, is commitment from the top. If all they're doing is delivering this message and not following through, you're not going to get cost cuts. So I'm not suggesting that you're going to be able to track all of these for a company, but when the company of value announces a $3 billion cost cut, don't take the number as a given, because in many cases, those cost cuts don't get delivered. Second, natural inclination when you see these mature companies is let's pump up the growth. Increasing growth will increase value, not necessarily. This is actually a graph that looks at return on capital globally for companies against the cost of capital. And in 2014 globally, in this case, I just focused on just companies which are I looked at only 50 million or greater market cap because the small companies were really, truly bad. But if you look at companies with a market cap greater than 50 million globally, 54% of all companies earned a return on capital less than the cost of capital. You think, who cares? To create value from growth, what do you need to do? You need to earn more than your cost of capital, right? So before you suggest to a company that goes and pushes for more growth, you need to check to see that it can earn more than the cost of capital. A lot of companies, increasing growth will actually reduce your value, not increase your value. And third and final point, we talked about debt ratios. All too often, when you see valuations of companies that appraisers do or bankers do, one of the big questions you get caught up on is, should I use the actual debt ratio or should I use a target debt ratio? And usually people make up target debt ratios or use industry averages. The answer to that question is, why not both? Why can't you start with the actual and move to the target? But if you want to talk about target debt ratios, rather than talk about industry averages, you want to talk about the right mix of debt and equity for your company, right? If that sounds familiar, it's because that's exactly what we did in corporate finance in the capital structure section, where we changed the debt ratio for a company and saw what happened to the cost of equity and the cost of debt, because both will change as the debt ratio changes. So here's Hormel's existing cost of capital, 6.79%, and how that cost of capital changes as they go to 20% debt, 30% debt, and see why I ended up using a cost of capital of the debt ratio of 30 to 40%. It's because that's where the cost of capital was minimized. It was actually around 38 or 39 was the actual mix. So the mix of debt and equity that minimizes the cost of capital is where I was focused on when I thought about pushing the debt ratio out to 40%. So as you look at a company, don't automatically assume that cost cuts are feasible. Don't automatically assume that growth is good. And don't automatically assume that increasing your debt ratio is going to lower your cost of capital. It's really going to be company specific. Any questions on mature companies? Now let's talk about the most depressing valuations of all. Valuing a company in decline. If you're valuing JCPenney, my condolences. There's no good narrative you can tell about any of these companies, right? You look at Sears, you look at JCPenney, there is no light at the end of the tunnel, and it's a train coming at you full speed. Because all you can see for these companies, at least maybe I'm being pessimistic, is most of these companies, the end game is going to be that they can either get smaller, that's their best case scenario, or the worst case scenario is they'll cease to exist. So as you go through the questions, here's what you're going to see. When I ask you, what are your cash flows from existing assets, not only are they low, but they're declining. Your revenues are dropping, your margins are dropping. When you think about value from growth, you're saying, what growth? I'm just trying to get whatever I can from what I have. And your risk might actually change, especially if you have a lot of debt and you're a declining company, then bad things can happen to you if you don't pay down the debt. And you're never going to become a mature company. That was behind you. So now you're talking about liquidation value rather than a terminal value. The biggest challenge in valuing declining companies is actually psychological. What I mean by that is when you sit down, well, you know, if you go through my spreadsheet and you get to that revenue growth number, you want to enter a positive number, right? It's almost like entering a negative number is not the right thing to do. People hate to put in revenues going down, but with these companies, that's what you might have to do. But then you have to be internally consistent. If you're expecting a company to get smaller over time rather than bigger, what should your reinvestment look like? It should actually be a negative number. You're taking money out of the business rather than putting money in. Your free cash flow to the firm will actually be greater than the after-tax operating incomes. One of the few scenarios where it's okay. You're liquidating the company over time as you make it smaller. And you still have to ask the end question. What do I think this company will look like after it shrunk? Because there are two possibilities. One is you can bring it down to a smaller, more viable entity and say, hey, now you can continue. Or you can say at the end of 5 or 10 years, the company ceases to exist. But that's assuming the company is run sensibly, right? Why sensibly? Because if you're in a declining business, you should be shrinking revenues. You should be partially liquidating. But if you're the manager of a company, what are you going to be inclined to do? You want to be the savior. You want to turn the company around. Think about BlackBerry. Think of Yahoo. You want to make the company a growth company again. And if you do that, your valuation will actually be lower than the value that you get as a declining company. But as an investor, if that's what you see happening in the company, you might have to build in that bad reinvestment and bad growth and make your company a less valuable company and hope and pray. Your status quo value will have growth. Your optimal value will have negative growth. You'll be a shrinking company. So let me try this. About 7, maybe 8 years ago, I valued Sears, and I valued it right after a guy called Eddie Lampert took a position in Sears. And he took a position in Sears because he said, hey, you know what? This company is ripe for a takeover. And he bought it because of its real estate holdings. That's what his primary target was. He's saying, what real estate holdings? Go around the country. These huge Sears properties on land on which they have 20, 30, 50-year leases. That's a real estate. So what Eddie Lampert was looking at is maybe if I shut down half the stores and capitalize it, take it back that value from the real estate, I'm going to make my money back. So I valued Sears right after he came in as the lead investor because clearly he was going to push to make the company smaller. So as you look at this valuation, you're going to see some numbers that look very strange relative to all the valuations we've done. So here's what they look like right now. They have a reinvestment rate of minus 7%. They're actually taking money out. Their return on capital is 5%. So file that away. They have stores out there that are making only a 5% return on capital. Their cost of capital is 7.5%. So collectively, their existing investments stink. So here's what I assumed would happen over the next 5 years. I assumed that they would shut down stores. This makes sense. And as you're shutting down stores, are you going to shut down your best stores or your worst stores? You're actually going to shut down your worst stores. So I used a negative reinvestment rate. That's the shutting down of stores. And the return on capital that I used was of those stores that are actually earning the lower returns. And what am I hoping will happen? That after 5 years, after I've shut down half the stores, that I'm going to be left with a core in Sears. And this might be hopeful thinking. That core, as a smaller core, will be able to operate like a healthy firm. So maybe a smaller, more focused Sears could create value. That's the story I'm telling in this valuation, and the numbers reflect that story. So you get a negative growth rate for the next 5 years because you have negative reinvestment. And at the end of 5 years, I'm assuming that the stores that are left over are going to earn their cost of capital. I'm not asking for miracles. I'm just saying, just earn your cost of capital at the end of 5 years. So the return on capital after 5 years is equal to the cost of capital. So if you look at my projections then, my revenues are going to decrease, my cash flows are going to get smaller over time, that at the end of 5 years, you're going to get a terminal value. Discount them back at a cost of capital of 7.5%. The value that I get for the operating assets is 17.6 billion. Add cash, subtract debt, I get a value for the equity. Notice the options have almost gone to nothing. This is another bonus you get when you have a declining firm. Because all the options were issued when the share price was 3 times higher, it's pretty much gone to zero. The value per share that I got was $87.29. You know what why Eddie Lampert's investment in Sears didn't quite work out? Did this in 2007, hoping to cash out real estate, right? Talk about timing problems. Basically, by the time he'd actually got control of Sears, it was 2008, and of course, the bottom of the real estate market collapsed post-crisis. So these are all investments where even the best laid plans by smart people can come apart because something macro changed around it. But that's the perspective in valuing a declining company, is being willing to accept the fact that you can have negative growth, negative reinvestment. The only judgment you have to make is, at the end of this, am I going to have a liquidation value because there's nothing left, or am I going to have a continuing going concern value of a smaller company? Any questions of declining companies? Okay. Now, what adds to the stress is you have a declining company with a lot of debt, because then there's a sword hanging over you, right? Because if you don't make those debt payments, you're going to go bankrupt. So when you do a DCF, and I mentioned this last session, you're doing a going concern value, and if you have distress hanging around, then you're going to overvalue a company. And that's always going to be true. There is no way that a traditional discounted cash flow valuation can be changed enough to reflect the likelihood of distress. So I'm going to, again, use an example to illustrate what to do if you have a company where there's a significant chance your company will not make it. And this is going to be useful for those of you evaluating highly levered companies. We worry about, hey, will this company make it? It's also going to be useful for those of you evaluating young companies. You know why you're worried there, right? Your DCF tells you what the value of this company will be if everything works out. But there you worry about, what if I don't make it? So either case, you're worried about company not making it, truncation risk. I'm going to give you a simple technique for dealing with it. So the company I'm going to value, a company called Las Vegas Sands. Familiar with it? Who's the lead stockholder in Las Vegas Sands? Sheldon Adelson owns 51% of the company. One of the fastest growing casino companies of the last decade. So if you've been to Singapore, you've probably seen that obscenity that gets called the Marina Bay Sands, which is like this big boat on top. I mean, it's like all casinos. It's just overdone, you know, massively out of bad taste. But that's okay. It's very expensive, bad taste, big buildings. Expensive buildings. And here's the problem with casino companies. They're all run by egomaniacs. And take a look at all of them. Steve Wynn, who hate to give up control. He's saying, so what? You want to grow fast by building new casinos. You don't want to issue shares because you're going to give up control. Guess what you're going to do? You're going to borrow money like crazy. And that's basically how Las Vegas Sands grew much of the last decade. And through 2007, this was okay because you were building casinos in Macau, in Singapore, in Vegas. And you were borrowing money to do it. But since the casinos were doing well, nobody noticed. And of course, the bottom fell out at the end of 2008. So this was a valuation edit of Las Vegas Sands in February 2009. And as I was doing it, every news story I was reading about Las Vegas Sands was about, will this company make it? Because it was facing these huge debt payments, and there was this very real concern that the company would not make it. So here's what I did. I shut my mind to those news stories and said, I'm going to value Las Vegas Sands on the assumption that it gets back to health and makes it. And remember what I said on a spreadsheet? You can take the most screwed up company in the face of the earth and make it a healthy company. So help me out here. You want to make a screwed up company a healthy company, you're going to take those negative margins or low margins and make them into nice, healthy margins. You're going to take the high debt ratio and you're going to make it into a more sustainable debt ratio. And that's effectively what I did in the spreadsheet. I improved margins. I nursed the company back to financial health. I gave it these nice big earnings. I fixed its debt problem, at least in the spreadsheet. And I came up with a discounted cash flow value for the company of $8.12. Stock was trading at $4.25. So ask me the question. Did I buy it? I wasn't even interested in getting close to the stock, which led to some soul searching, because if the stock is $4.25 and my value is $8.12, I should be buying, right? There's something in my own valuation that's not clicking with me. And what am I not capturing in the $8.12? That's a value for Las Vegas Sands if it goes back to health and becomes a viable company. What am I worried about after all those news stories? That it might not make it, right? So I embarked on a different mission. I said, let me figure out what the chance is that Las Vegas Sands will not make it and what will happen if it doesn't make it. So to answer the first part of the question, here's where I went. I went to the bond market. Because you got to give those bond guys credit. They're fixated, right? They're fixated on one thing. Will you make it? Will you make it? Will you pay me? They don't get distracted by things like growth and potential and promise. Will you pay me? You won't pay me? Your credit risk went through the roof. So I went to the bond market. I found a 7-year bond. And the 7-year Las Vegas Sands bond that I found traded at $529. Now, if you remember, the way we price bonds usually is we take the promised coupons. So think back to fixed income or foundations. You take the promised coupons and the face value, and you discount them back at a risk-adjusted interest rate, right? That's basically how we price bonds. I'm going to price this bond a little differently. Instead of taking promised coupons, I'm going to take expected coupons. You're saying, what the heck is that? To get your promised coupon, what has to be true? The company's got to be live and standing, right? So basically what I do is I take the promised coupon and I multiply it by the probability that you'll be around to make the payment. So 1 minus the likelihood that you will go out of business. And because I've adjusted the cash flows for risk, I can discount back at the risk-free rate. It's a very different way of pricing bonds. But I have the price for the bond, I have the promised coupon, I have the risk-free rate. What's the only thing I don't have? I don't have the probability that you will not make it, but using the solver function in Excel, I can solve for it. And I came up with an annual probability of about 23%. So each year there's a 23% chance that Las Vegas Sands will not make it according to the bond market. You go back to the previous page. Nirvana is out there in year 10, right? To get to year 10, I've essentially got to survive 10 years in a row. So actually that should be raised to the power 10 for some reason. All my powers have gone away. So basically, I have to survive year 1, year 2, and since there's an 87% chance of surviving each year, I have to survive 10 years in a row. The likelihood that I will make it across an entire decade is only 23%. So if I listen to the bond market, it's saying there's only a 23% chance that Las Vegas Sands will make it. The remaining 77% of the time, something bad is going to happen. So let's step back. My discounted cash flow value, $8.12. is the value for Las Vegas Sands as a going concern. There's a 23% chance of it being a going concern. The remaining 77% of the time, what's going to happen? The company is going to have trouble making its debt payments. What does it then have to do? Sell a bunch of very expensive casinos to whom? To Steve Wynn, who's also in trouble when you're in trouble. which effectively means that you're going to get not even the market value of these buildings. You'd be lucky to get half the market value. And it's really about you as an equity investor. The bottom line is, given the amount of debt they owe, if they're unable to make a debt payment, your equity is going to go to zero. They might get restructured and come back out as a company, but it's not going to be your equity that comes out of it. It's going to be a fresh new equity issue. So my value of equity is going to be a weighted average of those two numbers, and that weighted average of $1.92 is still below my $4.25. So with distressed companies or companies where you worry about will the company, don't try to adjust your discount rate. It's not designed for that. Think about doing two valuations and think about attaching a probability to the company not making it. That's a much more effective way of bringing in that risk than trying to adjust the discount rate for that risk. Any questions? Yes.
When we look at the probability of default across 10 years, are they completely independent events?
No, this is a very, very rough estimate. So in a sense, you can, if you got a nice 10-year zero coupon bond, be nice, much nicer. But you're never going to get a distressed company have one nice 10-year zero coupon bond. So this is one way. Go to the bond market. The other is, if you're familiar, Ed Altman has this table where if you give me the rating for a bond, you can estimate the probability that the bond will go bankrupt in the next 10 years. You can use that. Or you can use some statistical approach to estimate the probability. So, but one way or the other, you got to confront this because it is what's driving the risk in your valuation. Let's talk about emerging market companies. Again, frame it in terms of the four questions. What are your cash flows from existing assets? You look at the financials, and it's going to be a little messier. Nature of emerging market accounting is it might not give you a direct answer. You look at the value for growth. One of the problems with valuing growth in an emerging market company is if the country itself becomes more risky, all of a sudden good growth can become bad growth. It's happened in Brazil in the last year. Is as the risk has gone up, the cost of capital has gone up. It's not the company's fault. The country's risk has affected it. And the same effect, your company risk may be stable, but the country risk can change dramatically, making your cost of capital very different. And finally, you could be a very well-run company, but if the country crisis becomes large enough, it could put you at risk. So with emerging market companies, the country is lurking in the background constantly in everything you do, whether you like it or not. So here are some suggestions I would have if you're working with emerging market companies. First, you have to bring in country risk somewhere into the process, but you've got to be careful about how you bring it in. Don't use the bludgeon approach. You're a Brazilian company, therefore you're exposed to Brazilian country risk. You have to think about those revenue exposures you get in different countries. Not all emerging market companies are made equal. You don't have to use the Lambda approach. It's a more difficult approach, but at least adjust your equity risk premium to reflect where the company generates its revenues. So I'll give you an example. There's a company that I valued off and on for the last decade. It's Embraer. Embraer is a Brazilian aerospace company. We calculated the cost of capital earlier in the class. But it's a Brazilian aerospace company that at least at the time that I did this valuation got 90% plus of its revenues from outside Brazil. So rather than give it the cost of capital of a Brazilian company, the way I built up to a cost of capital is first I did everything in US dollars. Why? Because at the time that I did this valuation, getting a risk-free rate in nominal reais was really difficult to do. So I switched currencies. I gave it a lambda to reflect the country risk. And if you don't want to use a lambda, use a weighted average equity risk premium, which effectively meant that their cost of equity was not that different from the cost of equity for Boeing because they got so much of their revenues globally. Their cost of debt reflects the country default risk, so country default risk enters their cost of capital. And the value that I get then reflects those assumptions driven into the cost of capital. So if you see the value that I get, $9.53, which works out to about 15.72 in real prices, it's a little lower than the market price, but it reflects my perception of Embraer as not just a Brazilian company, but a Brazilian company with a significant portion of its revenues outside. So if you're working with an emerging market company and look at the cost of capital, make sure that you're not just attaching the country's equity risk premium to that company, especially if it gets its revenues outside. Second, it's the point I made about the dollar. Currency should not matter. Why? Because currency drives inflation. If you have a high inflation currency, your discount rates will be higher, but so will your cash flows. So pick whatever currency you feel comfortable valuing the company in. So if you feel really uncomfortable valuing a Mexican company in pesos, I would like you to value it in pesos, but if you feel really uncomfortable, switch your valuation to US dollars. Do it in US dollars. Because as long as you're consistent, it's basically going to average out. Third, with emerging market companies, you are going to get that corporate governance issue pop up. You'll have voting and non-voting shares. You'll have a family control of the company. Nothing you can do about it, right? In fact, we talked a little bit about this in the start of the class test last session, where I said, would you discount the company? And I think we decided that if you already are reflecting the bad corporate governance in your numbers, there is no need to discount the value for bad corporate governance. It's already in there. So I'll give you an example. This was a few years ago when I went back to my hometown in India. An old friend of mine who runs this company, is part of the it's a family-run company, came to me and said, will you come in and talk about the value of a company? Because we think the market's treating us really unfairly. And the reason he felt the market was treating him unfairly was the market price per share was 100 rupees per share, which is about 4.5 times earnings. And he said, we're a good company, we grow a lot, I don't know why the market is punishing us the way it is. So I had some free time and I said, you know what, I'll come in and do a valuation of the company. Let's see if in fact the market is treating you badly. So I'm going to go through the numbers and I want you to take the perspective of disinterested outsiders. And what I want you to think about is if I were running the company, you being the one running the company, what would I do differently? So here's what I noticed. It's a company which had $4.4 billion rupees in after-tax operating income, and a huge reinvestment rate, 113%. In fact, when I did my valuation, I looked across time, and one reason the reinvestment was so large was because they did a big acquisition in the most recent year, and I smoothed things out, and I'll come back and talk about, you know, what my defense for the smoothing out was. I gave them a reinvestment rate of 60%, lower than their existing reinvestment rate. And the return on capital that they have right now, which is about 9% in rupee terms. That doesn't sound bad, right? 9% return. But this is a very different time for the rupee risk-free rate. The cost of capital in rupee terms is 16.9%. So they're growing. He's right. Technically, they are growing. They're growing about 5.5% a year, but they're growing really badly. So let it play out. Because they seem to be unaware of the fact that they were growing badly. I said, what's going to stop them? The family runs the company. It's not like after 5 years they're going to reassess. They're going to keep doing this in perpetuity. So what happens to a company that keeps taking bad projects in perpetuity? Well, I've got to value the company on the assumption that there's going to be this leakage of value that continues forever. To cut a long story short, because they're reinvesting so badly, the value that I got per share was about 62 rupees. So I finish it. They're all shocked because they'd been expecting me to come back and say 150 rupees, the market's being unfair to you, you should go and complain to the market. And I said, you know what, the market's being kind to you. It's giving you a 62 rupee value. So what about growth? In fact, the first reaction they had was, maybe you underestimated growth. Why do you use 112% reinvestment rate? I said, do you really want me to? Because you know what's going to happen as I raise that reinvestment rate, what's going to happen to my value per share? I reinvest more, actually drops to 40 rupees. In fact, I play this game of changing the reinvestment rate from 60% to 40% to 20% to 0%. And as I went from 60 to 0%, the value per share kept climbing. It's very depressing if you're a manager, because what am I saying? Why are you wasting your time looking at projects? Stop. Because the less you look at projects, the more value that I get per share. So after about 30 minutes of getting over the denial, they said, well, what should we do? And I said, the answer is pretty simple. You can tell them, right? Stop taking bad projects. This is not rocket science. No, forget it. The past may be difficult to fix. Let's face it. If you took bad projects in the past, it's very difficult to make them good projects. But at least stop taking bad projects. So what I did was I kept the existing projects as is. And I changed the return on capital in the new projects, not even to the cost of capital. I said, just push it up towards your cost. It might require a miracle to get up to 16%, but why don't you push it up to 12%? That should be doable, right? Because if you can push it up to 12%, the value per share goes to 84. If you can push it up to 16%, the value per share goes to 100. So if you can just take zero net present value projects, or not take projects at all, your value per share is 100. If you can fix your existing projects, that's even better, right? Because if you can take your existing projects and make them, then basically what you're going to get is that efficiency growth kick in, right? Because your return on capital is going to improve. That's going to push up the growth rate, and the value that you get is 111 rupees. From 60 to 84 to 111, all because the return on capital. So if you're valuing a company and your value per share looks low, take a look at the return on capital you're assuming for this company over the growth period. If it's lower than the cost of capital, increasing your growth rate is not going to help you. Reinvesting more is not going to help you, because you're on this path of destruction, value destruction. You're going to make it go on steroids as you reinvest more. So that's basically something to think about with the emerging market companies, though, is when you value these companies, you are going to get a value that reflects the existing management of the company. So the final question I asked is, hey, what should we do? I said, look around the table. You've got an awful lot of family members here. Maybe you need to change the game. Maybe you need to bring in new blood, maybe new management in here to think about these projects, because you're set in your ways, but you're set in bad ways, and it's showing up in your value. We talked about cross holdings, minority holdings, majority holdings. Companies all over the world have them. But especially with emerging market companies, this can become front and center. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a presentation I did a couple of years ago for the Tata Group in India, one of the largest family groups in India, oldest family groups, where I actually went in and talked to their top managers about four of the Tata companies. I picked just four because I know they have lots and lots, but these were four big companies. And the four Tata, don't even try to read these numbers, because I'm going to cut to the chase on what these companies is. The four companies I looked at were Tata Chemicals, Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Consulting Services. Four crown jewels of the Tata Group. Four independent companies. So if you buy shares, you actually buy shares in one of these four companies. You actually don't buy shares in the group. So I did a discounted cash flow evaluation of each of them. And remember how you do it? You take free cash flow to the firm, you discount the cost of capital, you get a value for the operating assets, then you add cash, then you add cross holdings, and then you subtract our debt. So with each one, I had to go through this process. And here's why I want to talk about these companies. When I value these companies, here's how the end value for the company worked out to be. The blue was my free cash flow to the firm discounted the cost of capital, so traditional operating assets. The red was the value of the cross holdings that each company had. So if you take Tata Chemicals, half the value of the company comes from holdings in other Tata companies. If you look at Tata Steel, almost half comes from... So in basically all these companies, about half the value of the company comes from holdings in other companies. In fact, the company that had the least cross holdings was Tata Consulting Services. Why? Those of you familiar with the Tata Group, tell me what it is about Tata Consulting Services that makes the holdings so much lower. How did Tata Chemical, Tata Steel, and Tata Motors end up with those cross holdings? Because until 30 years ago, these were privately, this was a private company. And the way capital was supplied across the company, Tata Steel had a really good year. They invested in Tata Motors. So it was an internal capital market. So the way these cross holdings evolved was over history, these companies supplied capital to each other. Now do you see why TCS has the least? It's the youngest of the companies. It's not been around that long. In fact, it's been around for only about 20 years in its current form. So it hasn't had that chance to accumulate the cross holdings. You're saying, so what? Let's assume that you found, in this case, I think, let's pick a company that came out. Let's take Tata Steel. It looks undervalued, right? Stock price is 632, the value is 844. In fact, I think that was the company, the CFO of Tata Steel was actually in the second row. He put up his hand and said, would you buy Tata Steel? Looks like it's cheap. And I had to tell him the truth, which is I will never buy a Tata company. So what? Well, good companies. I said, buying a Tata company is like getting married, and the day after you get married, your entire set of in-laws move into the bedroom with you. You might get along really well with your in-laws, but you don't want them all in the bedroom with you. You see the analogy? Basically, I want to buy Tata Steel. But if I try to buy Tata Steel, what do I get? I get Tata Steel and all the in-laws. Tata Chemicals, Tata Motors, all those cross-holdings. And with many of these companies with lots of cross-holdings, that is the biggest problem, is you don't get a clean play on the company because you're going to get all these other companies with it. So if you're doing an emerging market company, factor that in because it is going to be a factor. Final point, and then we'll end for the day. Talked about truncation risk, right? Coming from distress, coming from a company not making it. With emerging market companies, and thank God for this, it's happening in fewer countries than it used to, there is one more truncation risk you have to think about, which is your company could be nationalized. You're saying, what do I do about that? Well, let's assume that you value Gazprom. Bad mistake, if you ask me, but some of you are valuing Gazprom. You come up with a value of 180 billion. Firm is 30 billion debt outstanding. So that's 180 minus 50 is 150 billion is the value of equity, right? Now let's assume there are 15 billion shares. 150 billion divided by 15 billion gives you $10 per share. So far, so good. But then I tell you there is a chance, let's say 40% chance, the Russian government could end up nationalizing the company. How do you bring that into your valuation? The 150 billion is the value of the company as a going concern. What happens if you get nationalized? Will you get fair value? What's the definition of nationalization? Is you're not going to get fair value. They can dress it up anyway. You might get half of fair value. You might get book value. But let's say they give you book value. And book value is 50 billion. You know what value you're going to attach to the company? You're going to attach the 60% times the 150 billion plus the 40% times the 50 billion. And if nationalization is punitive and you get nothing, it could be zero for the second number. Your weighted average is what you'll be willing to pay for the company. It's why Venezuelan stocks trade at 3x earnings. Take a look. They look incredibly cheap on an earnings basis. But if you worry about, will that company be mine in 3 years or 5 years, this is the only place to show it is through that value. So when we start off next session, we'll start off with the sectors. We'll look at banks and we'll look at, you know, commodity companies. But you're ready to finish your DCF. So if you haven't quite finished those last steps, get it done and get to me before Friday if you can. Thank you.
I'm wondering, for what are the exchange rate that you use for historicals? Is it the exchange rate the year or spot?
The historicals is based on accounting convention, which is usually depends on whether it's a flow or a stock. Balance sheet items are converted at the end of the year exchange rate. Income statement items are converted. Is it a U.S. company or is it a...
Because it's like a Euro. Yeah.
It might be IFRS. I think it's converted based on an average exchange rate across the year.
Okay. And, like, I'm having a bit of trouble wrapping around how I should think about the company because it's in a pretty small space. It's like 10 years old. And
what does it do?
It's a video game software developer, and there's only, like, six of them that are public.
In Europe or across the world?
No, across the world.
Only six video game gaming companies?
They're public. Because they usually own subsets of studios, and then the studios actually make the games.
Well, I mean, you could either stick with six video game companies or think of it as entertainment software.